From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump is campaigning today in his home state of Florida, where he plans to cast his vote tomorrow. Joe Biden, meanwhile, is giving a speech today on the pandemic in his home state of Delaware. At last night's final presidential debate, both men painted a very different picture of the health crisis that's killed hundreds of thousands of Americans. Here's President Trump.
It will go away. And as I say, we're rounding the turn. We're rounding the corner. It's going away.
And that was in stark contrast to comments from Joe Biden.
We're about to go into a dark winter, And he has no clear plan. And there's no prospect that there's going to be a vaccine available for the majority of the American people before the middle of next year.
For a look at what we learned in the final debate before the election, here's NPR senior political editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, why don't we start with how each candidate portrayed the pandemic? What stuck out to you?
Well, you know, it was the entire first half hour of the debate, which is what most people likely wound up watching most. And, you know, a lot of it was Trump on the defensive. You know, he'd rather talk about almost anything else than this. You know, he wants things to open back up. He wants to move on from the pandemic. And a majority of Americans continue to disapprove of the way he's handling it. And cases are spiking all around the country. So that's a place Biden was happy to be in. He laid out a plan. And the Trump administration continues with mixed messages, insisting they don't want to tell states what to do, except that he wants schools to open and for businesses to open back up. You know, Biden also spoke about the president's efforts to, you know, like you said, have talked about with healthcare and with the coronavirus. They're all intertwined.
Let's talk about healthcare. Biden spoke about the president's efforts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. Health experts say that would take away healthcare from millions of people. But the president accused Joe Biden of wanting to socialize medicine, which Biden denied. He said he would keep private insurance. After the president mentioned Bernie Sanders, Biden said this.
He thinks he's running against somebody else. He's running against Joe Biden. I beat all those other people because I disagreed with them.
Well, Domenico, what do you make of Biden's efforts to distance himself there from the progressive wing of his party, not just, by the way, on health care, but also on fracking, which he said he would not ban except on federal property?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't new. Biden, like Biden said, you know, Trump has tried to paint him as a socialist, has tried to make him look like a Trojan horse for the quote unquote radical left. It's why Trump, frankly, didn't want to run against Biden in the first place, because it's a much harder thing to stick to him. And while that doesn't make progressives happy, a lot of Biden's positions do line up with the middle of the electorate. And that's why you've continued to see him overperform with white voters, especially older voters, and see if it holds. You know, that's going to be a big piece of this. You know, and it's a needle that Biden really had to thread to win the nomination. I mean, he and President Obama believe in a lot of these progressive ideas, but believe you have to win first, and that making progress is about making things better and won't happen overnight, as President Obama said in Philadelphia.
President Trump criticized former Vice President Biden for not getting enough done during the Obama administration. Here he is talking about the criminal justice reform issue.
You were vice president along with Obama as your president, your leader, for 8 years. Why didn't you get it done? You had 8 years to get it done. Now you're saying you're going to get it done because you're all talk and no action, Jim.
We got a lot of it done.
Maybe you can respond to that. Domenico, Biden said the Republican Congress was one reason that he and Barack Obama could not get certain things done. What's your reaction to what was said by both?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously there are three chambers or three pieces of being able to pass some, of this policies. And, you know, the Obama administration focused at the beginning, of course, on the stimulus to try to save the country from the Great Recession, then moved on to health care. It had other things that, you know, people wanted them to prioritize, like immigration, for example. But, you know, they figured health care is a big ticket item. They were able to get something done on it. And now you see Joe Biden coming out with saying that he wants a public option on health care, which is something that the left was critical of President Obama for not having in the first place. And, you know, I think some of the activist wing of the party wants to, obviously, to go even further than that.
Do you think this debate moved the needle for any voters?
It's really unlikely. You know, I think that one Republican strategist I talked to this morning said that he thinks still Trump is going to lose, but that where this might make a difference is in red and purple states for those down ballot candidates, maybe some of those soft Republicans you know, who wouldn't have voted necessarily for, you know, their Senate candidates and might have voted all Democratic, now might split their tickets. But that was an interesting thing for the strategist to say, that he thinks still that they will split their tickets, meaning that they're not going to vote for Trump.
NPR's senior political editor, Domenico Montanaro, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, anytime there's a presidential debate, it's guaranteed to play out on social media, and that's where Femi Okeh spends a lot of her time. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, happy Friday. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you very much. So I checked
You're welcome.
Peter, I checked in with Google Trends to see what the most searched topics were as we were watching the presidential debate. Wages and unemployment came up really high once people were watching and following the conversation. And Joe Biden got checked out more than President Trump, which is understandable because we know President Trump from the last 4 years.
North Korea was also trending. Did you see that after this exchange between Biden and Trump?
North Korea, we're not in a war. We have a good relationship. You know, people don't understand. Having a good relationship
Trump,
with leaders of other countries is a good thing.
We have a lot of questions to get to. Your
response. Like saying we had a good relationship with Hitler before he, in fact, invaded Europe, the rest of Europe. Come on.
Well, Femi, always dicey anytime you bring up Hitler. What did you hear there?
One of the comments on social was, I picked Hitler for a drinking game. I never thought I'd have to actually have a drink for Hitler. So that appeared, and Hitler appeared during the conversation. You cannot absolutely decide what might come up, because it was a really intriguing conversation that was happening on the presidential debate and then on social as well. Amber, for instance, talking about North Korea, says how different the candidates were. So a real Donald Trump speaks of fellow dictators so lovingly. Joe Biden describes North Korea leader as a thug that he is, and she says, wow for that. Meredith Demina thinks that President Trump did really good on North Korea. He scored solid points. And then Gore Computer basically says both Trump and Biden did horribly on North Korea. They had very bad responses and replies. But basically every single question then elicited a whole thread of conversation from social, as they were basically commentating and rating the different candidates' way of responding to the questions.
Well, it was the last presidential debate, so luckily this will be the last time this election cycle we have to stay up late scrolling through Twitter
for
after
another
one of those
4 years.
listen, another important news event that happened this week, a very serious one. The protest in Nigeria against police brutality. Dozens of people have died, and many are speaking out against the violence, including U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
Yes, and one of the things that I'm seeing right here is it reminds me of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign. You remember that from several years ago, when in the northern part of Nigeria, some schoolgirls were abducted by an armed group called Boko Haram. That story went global, and this one is as well. Two reasons. One is because video is popping up in people's feeds of alleged instances of police brutality by Nigerian police. These videos are awful, horrific, scary, bloody, and that added to a hashtag which is trending globally, which is End SARS. And SARS is basically a special anti-robbery squad in Nigeria, now being disbanded because of all of the protests. But the police brutality is going on. So celebrities are actually jumping in on this campaign. For instance, Rihanna, she just shared on Instagram a bloody Nigerian flag. Hillary Clinton has also said, just very simply, I'm calling on President Buhari and the Nigerian army to stop killing young NSARS protesters. And this is really interesting from Beyonce, because she's not just saying NSARS and using the hashtag, but she said, we have been working with youth organizations to support those protesting for change, and we are collaborating with coalitions to provide emergency health care, food and shelter. So she's not just tweeting, she's not just posting on Instagram, she's actually doing action. And you could call this slacktivism, but in this instance, I don't believe it is, Peter, because the protesters in Nigeria are saying, we want you world to see what's happening, because that will embarrass the Nigerian government to act and to stop the police brutality that is happening to Nigerian citizens.
Well, it's an incredibly important story, and I'm glad to see that people are paying attention to it around the world. And we are going to follow that story elsewhere in today's show as well. Finally, Femi, people are talking about the end of Quibi. The mobile-only video streaming service, it died an early death less than 7 months after it was launched. The founder, Jeffrey Katzenberg, spoke with CNBC yesterday.
Somewhere between the idea being less than perfect, which we own, and the environment we found ourselves in, is where the fail has come.
Femi, I just learned, like, today or yesterday how to say the name of this company. I'm not even sure I said it right. Are people outraged or apathetic?
Postmortems online, people are saying, well, we had, there was lots of money, there were famous directors involved, lots of A-listers, but Hans-Michael Brecht sums up a lot of the social commentary and says, this was never going to work. Why would people pay for this kind of content when they can just watch YouTube for free? So there's a lot of analytical thought about what went wrong, and you can look that up at Quibi Fail.
Femi, okay. Thank you so much. Last night's final presidential debate between President Trump and Joe Biden was much more coherent than the first one. But did their message to voters come through with just 11 days left in the election season? Let's check in with three voters in the crucial swing state of Pennsylvania. Carly Long is a junior at the University of Scranton, and she's also president of the school's College Democrats. Michelle Marino-Taroli is a libertarian. She works at a community health clinic, and she's from West Pittston, Pennsylvania. And Joe Novakuski is a retired corrections worker, a Republican from Kingston. Welcome to all of you. Thanks for making the time to speak with us today.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you.
All right, and let's just go around the horn here briefly. I know you all watched the debate last night. In one word, Carly, start with you. Your reaction?
Better.
Michelle?
Pretty much the same. So let's say it's the same.
The same. And Joe?
Coherent.
Yeah, Carly, President Trump is trailing in the polls nationally, but and also in Pennsylvania. Only has 11 days left, though, to turn things around. Do you think, as a Democrat who wants to see Joe Biden win Pennsylvania, did anything happen that made you worry that Trump might pick up some votes?
I have to say, I was worried but kind of impressed. I think that he came off more presidential than he has in the past. I think he was much calmer, which I think was respectable. But I will say, I think that Joe Biden has been doing a much better job overcoming the narrative that he is weak. I think that he responded to accusations against him and to points against him very well and showed that he is not afraid to go after Trump. I think that he came off very presidential.
And Joe, do you think Donald Trump did any work to pick up some votes yesterday?
Yeah, I do agree. I think he did come across very presidential. He made his points very clearly, easily laid out what his positions were. That's about all I have.
Yeah. Well, you know, Pennsylvania got quite a few mentions last night. And on the topic of climate change, President Trump called out Joe Biden's plan to phase out fossil fuels to replace them with clean energy. Let's listen.
Because basically what he's saying is he is going to destroy the oil industry. Okay. Will you remember that, Texas? Will you remember that, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma?
Vice President Biden, let me give you 10 seconds to respond, Ohio. And then I have to get to the final.
And Biden referenced his birthplace of Scranton, Pennsylvania, in his response to Trump's assertion that the stock market will go up if Trump's elected. Here it is.
The idea that the stock market is booming is his only measure of what's happening. Where I come from in Scranton and Claymont, the people don't live off of the stock market. Just in the last three years during this crisis, the billionaires in this country made, according to the Wall Street, $700 billion more dollars.
Well, Carly, we're speaking to you from Scranton, Pennsylvania. Biden loves to say that he was born there. Does it resonate with people like you and your neighbors?
I think there is a little bit of a Scranton pride around Biden saying that. I think that it does mean a lot to the people of Scranton that he constantly mentions them, because I feel like Scranton is kind of overlooked a lot. But I don't think the issue of the oil industry will affect a lot of people my age in Scranton in terms of how they vote.
And that's because you live on a college campus. A lot of voters are more progressive, and they want to see Joe Biden go even further by endorsing the Green New Deal, for instance.
I would agree. I would say that, again, this is just me as a voter, not me as the president of College Democrats. I don't think Joe Biden's plan goes far enough in terms of climate change, but I think that many people would actually say that his position last night was a step in the right direction with more progressive Democrats.
Yeah, well, Carly, Joe Biden's going to need enthusiasm among young people like you across the state of Pennsylvania to win. Do you think you know, college-age students, people in their 20s are going to go out and support him, from what you can tell?
Would I say enthusiasm? Maybe not necessarily that's the word I would use. However, I think that young people really do understand the stakes of this election, and I think that they do understand the importance of voting. Many people understand the issues at stake in this election, one of which is the environment, and I think that's very important to people my age.
Joe, what about that moment when President Trump asks Pennsylvania voters to remember when Biden says that he's going to transition away from fossil fuels? What did you make of that moment?
Well, as far as fossil fuels goes in Pennsylvania, it's a major issue. There's been a lot of gas exploration and gas production throughout Pennsylvania, especially northeastern Pennsylvania as well. As Vice President Biden stated, he wants to phase it out. I don't know how he is possibly going to do that and maintain a quality of life, actually life itself. I mean, how do you phase out fossil fuels and produce food? How do you get to work? How do you heat your home? I mean, it's not just a snap of the finger issue that you can just automatically turn on the wind turbine.
Yeah. Well, Michelle, I want to bring you in. You're the Libertarian. Clearly, both candidates are courting Pennsylvania's voters aggressively, not only in this debate, but in this campaign. And as the Libertarian, someone who's not supporting either of them, you kind of have a unique, more of a removed view. What do you think about the message that they're sending to Pennsylvania voters, and who has the edge?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I can tell you that in my area, there is a large support for Trump. They seem to appeal to their bases more than anything. I don't see a lot of crossover as far as trying to appeal to what's best for the American voters. I find it very polarized. They're both very similar. They're different in their approach, but as far as policies and the history of both parties, there's not much difference there.
Well, in fact, third-party candidates played a pretty big role in 2016. They won 4% of the vote last time in Pennsylvania, and that was a margin that kind of helped tip the scale into President Trump's favor. Different story this year, Michelle. The Libertarian, Joe Jorgensen, doesn't have the same kind of support. So why vote Libertarian when so much is on the line in an election like this?
As far as Libertarians go, we, like I said, we don't see it as a lesser evil type of thing. We agree that both aren't bringing enough change, or really any change. So,
and what is that change you're looking for?
There is a lot of government overreach. There is extreme taxation and just too much dependency, I think, on laws and on regulations and things of that nature.
Well, let's talk for a minute about the actual mechanics of voting, because as you all know, this has become a story in the 2020 election. Raise your proverbial hand on the radio here if you can. Who's going to the polls and who's voting by mail?
I'm going to the polls.
I'll be going to the polls as well.
And Carly?
I'll be voting by mail.
Interesting. Okay, Carly, why are you deciding to vote by mail? And Joe and Michelle, are you going to the polls because you don't trust the mail?
That's about exactly right. I do not trust the mail. There's way too many news reports of fraud being committed by postal workers. I'm not saying that they're all bad. There's a lot of good ones out there. They're trying to make a living. But once again, it's the few are giving the many a black eye, and they've kind of like really ruined any idea about mail and voting for me.
Well, and Joe, I just want to point out, we do know that incidents of fraud are very limited. I just have to point that out. Michelle, how do you feel?
I choose to go to the polls because in general, I like to cut out the middleman. I feel like if I can go to the polls and not have to worry or wonder about what's going on in between mailing my vote in and it actually getting counted.
Sure. It feels good to go to the polls. Yeah, I understand. Carly, what about you?
I totally get that because this is the first election I'm able to vote in. So I understand wanting to go to the polls. But because of being a college student and, you know, class schedules and actually being able to get to the polls and also the current pandemic, that's just kind of the reasons why I chose to mail it in.
Well, there are big questions about what will happen on election night. This is the first year that vote by mail has been expanded to everyone in Pennsylvania, and there's some concerns that, you know, the vote could go longer than election day. Officials are worried that people will forget to send in their ballot without that security envelope that's required. These are so-called naked ballots that we've reported on. Do all of you have confidence that the election will actually go smoothly in this critical state of Pennsylvania?
No.
I agree. I think there will be issues.
You had mentioned that the instances of voter fraud or fraud as far as the voting U.S. Postal Service was concerned are few and far apart. Don't tell that to the people in Luzerne County. Right here, we had military votes thrown in the garbage, collected from the dumpster. So I don't know where you're getting your news, but it's not the right message to send us here.
It's true. That happened. There were a handful of ballots. Many of them were cast for President Trump. But Carly, tell me about your faith in the election system.
I obviously would love to say that I think it's a new completely smoothie, but honestly, I don't. I also think the fact that the candidates are saying that they will not accept the results of the election is also a bit concerning in terms of just democracy. But I think that there could potentially be issues.
Yeah. All right. Well, before I let you all go on to your day, is there anything that could happen in the next 11 days that could change your mind? Could anything upend this race for you?
The only thing that I can say is I'm going to be voting like a newborn baby's life depends upon it, because it actually does.
Anybody else?
There's really nothing that can change my mind. I think the issues at stake are so crucial, which is why it is important that everyone gets out and vote, because I just feel like with a Republican majority in the Senate, a super conservative majority on the Supreme Court, there needs to be some type of balance.
And Michelle, are you locked in?
Yes, I'm locked in. I feel like the best candidate, even though it is an uphill battle for third parties, I definitely feel like it is the best choice and one that could potentially unite both sides.
Well, the key to winning Pennsylvania is right here. The three of you, everyday people casting their ballots in the 2020 election. Thank you so much for your time. The Democrat Carly Long, Libertarian Michelle Marino-Tiroli, and Republican Joe Novakuski. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Have a great day now, all of you.
You too.
Uber and Lyft lost their appeal in a California court last night against an order for them to stop classifying their drivers as independent contractors. The ride-sharing companies say they'll have to pull out of California if they're forced to classify their drivers as employees. And meanwhile, voters will have a chance to weigh in on a ballot measure backed by both companies that would let app-based drivers continue to be independent contractors with some benefits. For more, we're joined by Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Lisa.
Let's dig into this case a little bit further. Why does the state of California say Uber and Lyft have to classify their workers as employees?
So it goes back to a California state law that was passed last year and went into effect at the beginning of this year. And what it does is it basically requires companies to reclassify a variety of freelance independent contractors as employees, you know, whether they be computer programmers or writers or, in this case, drivers for services like Lyft and Uber. And what that means is the companies then, these employees would be covered by labor laws. They'd be eligible in many cases for benefits like health insurance or sick leave and workers' comp. They'd be able to collect unemployment insurance. And the companies obviously fought that in court. A lower court ruled against them, and now this is an appeals court in California, a state appeals court that has upheld that lower court's ruling, saying that, no, these companies are not exempt from this new law.
So this is all depending on how voters answer a ballot measure on November 3rd. Uber and Lyft have spent a lot of money campaigning in support of this measure, Proposition 22. What's at stake here?
Well, for Uber and Lyft, what's at stake is simply the profits they make. Their business models very much are based around the notion that these drivers are freelancers, and that saves them a lot of money on those benefits that we were just talking about. And so much so that, as you point out, they're actually threatening that if this prop is not passed, that they may be forced to leave the state, ironically, the state where both of them were founded, California, or at least cut back service greatly. So, you know, that's what's at stake for the customers, is that, you know, these companies are basically threatening to leave California if this proposition doesn't get passed.
There's at least one survey in which 72% of app-based drivers in California support staying independent. I wonder overall how drivers feel about efforts to reclassify them as employees.
Well, I think both with drivers and really a lot of the workers who are affected by this bill, there's not really a universal agreement that they're for this bill. And I think what those surveys you pointed out, what it highlights is there are two distinct kind of so-called gig workers. For one, the gig job is actually how they make a living. They may be doing 40 or more hours a week for a company, so they may benefit from this law. But for others, in some cases, they may already have another full-time job, or they're a student or a parent raising a family, and they want that flexibility of the gig employment. They don't want to be committed to a full-time job. So there is this dichotomy of opinions between the two type of workers who are affected by it.
Thank you very much, Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you, Lisa.
The president of Nigeria is urging protesters to stay at home after a deadly shooting by his security forces Tuesday. They opened fire on an encampment of protesters in what's being called the Lekki Massacre. The protesters were there to call for an end of a branch of the police called SARS, or Special Anti-Robbery Squad. For more now, let's bring in Ader Peralta, who is NPR's East Africa correspondent based in Nairobi, Kenya. Ader, welcome.
Thank you, Lisa.
The protesters are primarily young people. First off, before we get to this event, what have they been demonstrating against?
So these protests started more than 2 weeks ago, and they were sparked by a video that went viral that showed one of the members of this special unit of the police. It's a special anti-robbery unit that's known as SARS. And it showed one of those members shooting a man and then just leaving him lying on the street. They just left. And this sparked massive protests in Nigeria. And one of the young people I spoke to said that this touched them because being young in Nigeria meant being scared. They were scared of this unit because they extorted them money. Many of them, you know, have been killed or maimed by this group. And so that was their main concern, was to end this SARS unit.
So talk about this particular incident that happened Tuesday night, where protesters were in an encampment. They were sitting down, singing the national anthem, holding the national flag, expecting the security forces would come but wouldn't fire on anybody who was holding a flag. But they were wrong. Tell us what happened.
They were wrong. It's important to sort of focus a little on what happened before, which is that these armed assailants had started attacking these peaceful protests. And then Monday into Tuesday, some of the demonstrators burnt down police stations. The governor of Lagos issued a 24-hour curfew. Protesters defied the curfew, and the military was sent to this place called Lekki Bridge, which is very iconic in Lagos. And they shut down the lights. Then they opened fire. The government has admitted that two people have died, but rights groups say that at least 12 people were killed.
Ader, the protests in Nigeria have been compared to the Black Lives Matter movement in the U.S. in that it's driven mainly by young people, doesn't have one spokesperson. In this case, though, it seems to be presenting in Nigeria a huge challenge to the government. So to what extent is the government truly threatened by these protesters?
Well, I mean, look, these protests, they started very focused on police brutality. But Nigeria is in a really tough moment right now. Unemployment is 27%. Then the oil prices tanked, and then this COVID pandemic came in and just delivered a bigger punch to this economy. And so what happened with these protests is that they became much broader. They attracted a huge swath of the Nigerian population. And something that will tell you what kind of challenge it presents to the government is that these are really the biggest protests that Nigeria has seen since the 80s, when people took to the streets to decry military rule.
Ader Peralta, NPR's East Africa correspondent, thank you for the update. Thanks.
Thank you, Lisa.
Farther south in Africa, the government of Zimbabwe is also using violence and extreme measures against protesters and against the media. Hopewell Chinono is a prominent investigative reporter who has helped reveal cases of brazen government corruption and the looting of funds meant to help in the fight against COVID-19. His reports have implicated members of the president of Zimbabwe's family and cost a health minister his job. In July, security forces retaliated. They broke into Chinono's home and arrested him on a charge of inciting violence against the government. The courts ordered him held without bail in a notorious, overcrowded maximum security prison where, he says, COVID-19 is rampant and protective gear is scarce.
It was a horrible experience because I was living in a prison cell meant for 16 people, and yet we were 44 people sleeping in that cell. There was no running water in the cell. We were locked up in that cell for 17 hours, and we were released in the morning and taken to a courtyard for 7 hours. In the courtyard, we would be 500 from one section, and we only had two toilets. There was no running water. When you left the section, you would be shackled. The only food that we got, porridge in the morning, cornmeal in the afternoon with boiled beans with nothing else, no cooking oil. And in the evening, cornmeal again with boiled cabbages. The hospital, the prison hospital, does not even have paracetamol. There's no medication. I saw people just lying on the ground, writhing in pain. So it was a terrible experience, one that I would not wish on my worst enemy.
You said you had heard about some of these conditions previously, but what the government, you think, didn't realize is by consigning you to the maximum security prison, you are now able to report with firsthand experience on the conditions there.
I think it was one of the most terrible mistakes that the state made by sending me to the Chikurubi maximum security prison, because I now had a front row seat watching how prisoners lived, watching how they are treated. I saw a prisoner being beaten so badly. They'd been found with their cell phone, which was not even working, but they'd forgot to surrender their cell phone. They were beaten badly, Lisa, to a point where they could not walk anymore. And I said to myself, this is a reflection of what has become of our country, because these beatings are taking place even outside prison. People that are perceived to be critics of the government or political rivals and adversaries of the president and his ruling elites, they are beaten up. And I'd heard about these things, and to see them up close and personal, it was, I would say from a journalistic perspective, fascinating. But from a human perspective, it was really depressing. And I've been writing about it. I've written two articles. And of course, the state cannot respond to what I'm saying because they know that I'm saying the truth.
Hopewell, why, if you saw all this, and I would assume they know that you're going to go back out and report on these things, why did they let you go?
They had no option because of the international pressure that had been mounted. Explaining to the president that you are arresting journalists who are exposing corruption. But if they had an option, they would have wanted us to stay in there and rot in there. I had been arrested for exposing the looting of money meant to help Zimbabweans deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. And this made the whole world mad, because most of these funds will be donations coming into the country to help us, because we don't even have a working health delivery system. A lot of our people are dying because of this corruption.
Hopewell, I know the situation you're talking about in Zimbabwe is specific to Zimbabwe, but resonates far beyond that as well. What are your thoughts in terms of what those on the outside need to know?
I think it's difficult to operate in a country like Zimbabwe. For instance, my arrest was meant to instill the fear of God in young journalists, to say that if we can arrest this big, well-known journalist, Hopewell Chingono, imagine what we can do with you. And that is the biggest problem that we face across the continent and beyond, because we have regimes that do not respect their constitutions. They do not respect the rule of law. They don't understand the importance of freedom of speech and the right for the media to do its work. And because of that, journalists end up locked up for doing what they are legitimately supposed to be doing, which is informing the citizens in order for the citizens to be able to make the correct decisions when they are interacting with public life and public officials.
Journalist Hopewell Chinono speaking to us from Harare, Zimbabwe. Thank you very much, Hopewell. We're glad you're doing well.
Thank you very much for having me on your program.
We're watching races in a handful of key states as Democrats try to flip the U.S. Senate. Paul Kane is senior congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. He joins us on a Skype line. Paul, help me do the math. Democrats need four more seats if President Trump wins re-election, and they need just three if Joe Biden wins because the vice president has the tie-breaking vote in the Senate. Where do Democrats stand right now?
Look, so there's 53 Senate Republicans right now. And they have twice as many seats that are up this cycle as Democrats do. So they're playing a lot of defense. But they do expect to pick up the seat in Alabama that Doug Jones, a Democrat, currently holds. That puts them at 54 seats. Now they have, depending on the day, they have two, three, or four incumbents who are in really precarious situations. Cory Gardner in Colorado, Martha McSally in Arizona, and Susan Collins up in Maine. After that, you have the North Carolina Senate race, and then Iowa is another sort of real pivot point race. If Republicans can hold those two, they're then looking at the what I call the two undecideds. That's Georgia. Right now, they've got two Senate races there, and both of those races look like they could end up as runoffs, and we won't know who holds the majority until January 5th, when those runoffs are held in Georgia. Now, that's sort of the optimistic Republican take on things. Democrats still feel like they have more roads to 50 or 51 than Republicans do, and they're still hoping to be able to do that on election night or within a couple days thereafter.
You mentioned Martha McSally in Arizona. I've been following that race pretty closely because I'm based here in Arizona. And what I've noticed for months is that McSally is trailing her opponent, the Democrat Mark Kelly, even further in the polls than President Trump, who's also behind in this state. And this is happening in other places as well. What's going on with that?
Yeah, these candidates who are on the ballot this year for Republicans, they are by and large pretty traditional Bush-Cheney Republican types who believe in strong national security issues, previously believed pretty much in free trade. And so they have always had been an odd fit with the Trump coalition. And there's just that little percentage of the vote that is really just a Trump voter, not really a Republican. Those voters have been holding out all year on people like Tom Tillis in North Carolina, McSally in your home state of Arizona. Maybe the most stark example of this is in South Carolina. There's just a block of Republicans who look at Lindsey Graham and they remember those days where he was working with Ted Kennedy and John McCain and Chuck Schumer trying to craft, you know, national immigration legislation that included a path to citizenship, just some things that were anathema to some real hardcore Trump voters. And so that's why all of a sudden Lindsey Graham is now fighting for his life against Democrat Jamie Harrison.
And by the way, Jamie Harrison is a candidate that has raised a tremendous amount of money in this race, and that's happening with a lot of Democrats this cycle. What do you make of that, and what role that's going to play in the race?
You're seeing these enormous record-setting sums, and it is in large part just a reaction against President Trump and any senator, any Republican senator who is viewed as somebody who has sort of aided and abetted Trump. You know, Beto O'Rourke was this force of personality 2 years ago and was raising this type of money, but he was doing it with this like incredible social media-driven personality campaign. And there are folks that are raising more money for really running kind of plain, ordinary, standard Democratic campaigns. And it's just because liberals are so angry right now.
We should point out O'Rourke, of course, lost. So it's not money that counts for everything.
There
are several scenarios now that could play out. Democrats could take the Senate but lose the White House and vice versa. Or they could win the Senate and the White House. Either way, the impact of this election is going to be huge in terms of legislation. Or the lack thereof of legislation, there could be a tremendous amount of gridlock. What do you make sort of on the significance of what we're facing down here in the next couple of weeks?
the current format of Congress, Republican president, Republican Senate, Democratic House, has basically meant gridlock. And so the question is, how do you break up that formula? Well, there's almost no chance of the Republicans taking the House of Representatives. And that means you scramble this with a Democratic president, but you still end up with a Republican Senate. If that's the case, you're still going to see the similar deadlock on big issues. But if the Democrats run the table and they take the White House and the Senate, there is going to be a lot of pent-up demand to do some really aggressive steps. And those can really only happen if the Democrats win back the Senate. If Mitch McConnell is sitting on a narrow majority, you're really looking still at gridlock, deadlock on the biggest issues of the day.
Paul Kane, senior congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you for your insights here. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Anytime.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.